This is the LarryInFishers.com podcast. My name is Larry Lannon, and for the first time, I am recording a podcast at the Department of Public Works facility off Eller Road in Fishers. My guests, Mayor Scott Fadness and our Fishers Department of Public Works Director Eric Pethtel. And gentlemen, the first time I had two of you on one podcast. I've had Eric on and Mayor several times. It's great to have you both together.
We're seldom allowed to be in the same room because of security issues, right?
Right.
If both of us go down, I don't know what would happen.
I've heard stories about these meetings, you know.
Yeah.
I guess they must be true. First thing I want to do, and Eric, I asked you if I could ask this question before we started. People know you've had some health challenges. I guess a lot of people around town wonder how you're doing. Give us an update on your health.
I would say, all in all things considered, I'm doing okay. I was diagnosed with a lung cancer 3 years ago, been under treatment for that. I had a setback in December 18th, where a known lesion on the femur had weakened the bone and it snapped, so I'm rehabbing through that and learning to walk all over again with this trusty walker of mine right next to me. But all in all, doing pretty good. Well enough to be back at work.
I was going to say, you look great. You sound great. It's good to see you back at work. And Mayor, I'm sure you're glad to see him back at work.
Yeah, I think he's the only guy I know that could be diagnosed with lung cancer and still go out and plow snow at night. He's a dedicated to his profession, to say the least, and to this community.
Fortunately, you haven't had too much snow to plow this
our barns are full, so we're in all cotton.
We have all the salt you can imagine. We're going to talk today about the history of Fishers, about a time capsule. But, Mayor, I do want to ask you one quick question before we start that.
Yes.
There's been a lot of publicity about this court case involving Carmel, the state of Indiana. And, of course, Fishers has an interest in this. You did give some comments to the Indianapolis Star about this, and I wrote a story last night on my blog just kind of trying to give people some perspective of what, you know, $10 million a year could mean to a city budget like Fishers. I was trying to think here. You'll be going through your budget process for 2025 in just a few months, and of course, the state legislature won't even meet until after that process is over. What are you thinking in terms of just, if nothing else, the 2025 budget in lieu of this court decision?
Yeah, it's a dramatic turn of events and an unfortunate one. I've been saying this, and honestly, my predecessors, you know, Scott Faulis, as we talk about history here, he used to talk about this all the time. And I don't think people truly understand the difference in financial realities between Fishers and Carmel. So when you add up the amount of additional property tax dollars that they collect in their general fund levy, and you add up the amount of income tax dollars they collect, the two main revenue streams that allow us to provide services to our community, on an annual basis, that's a difference of $60 million a year. $60 million a year. So to put that in some degree of perspective for our residents, our annual budget is a little over $100 million a year. So $60 million would fund our entire police department, fire department, parks department, and a portion of our public works department. That's how much additional money Carmel has to provide the same level of service to the same population base as the city of Fishers has. So when people scratch their head and wonder how Carmel can build, you know, 50 umpteen roundabouts or put statues in the middle of all of them and things of that nature, It those financial realities matter. It matters that, you know, they have 40 more public safety professionals than we do. Why? Because they just literally have more money than we do. We've been fighting this battle for a long time. There was a temporary solution regarding this. And so the court overturned it. We're continuing to evaluate that process. I don't have any comments moving forward yet. We're still evaluating everything. So does a $10 million matter an awful lot? Absolutely. That was at least making it tolerable. Doing away with that makes the financial realities literally unsustainable under their current form. And I mean, I've been talking about this since I was an intern. Scott Faulis was talking about it before I was here. Something has to change sooner rather than later.
Well, one technical question, if I can. In this lawsuit, as I understand it, Carmel did not sue Fishers. Carmel sued state. So it's up to the state as to whether there's
correct.
An appeal.
We're not a party to the lawsuit at this point.
Just so people understand, you know, who the parties are. Well, sorry we had to start the podcast with that, but that's, you know, I'm a news guy, and that's
news.
That's the most important and timely news.
Absolutely.
But we want to talk about history and the time capsules being placed underneath the new City Hall Arts Center that will soon be opening. So I'm going to start off with Eric. By a few months, you have more time in Fishers than I do. So you have the seniority on this panel as far as living in Fishers. Tell us how long you've lived in Fishers and the memories that you have about what some people call the old Fishers.
Well, I've been here since February of 1991. And it was really a small community back then, just a few stoplights, and I don't know if we had any roundabouts back then. They were unheard of, but certainly the biggest change that I've recognized through the years is the population.
Well, yes, the population was, I always tell people when I moved, it was 1990, I think it was just a little over 7,500. It was the census population of Fishers at that time. And you look at somewhere between 100,000 and 105,000 now, that's just an amazing change. So that's obviously the biggest one. But when you think about Fishers, and I think about this too, when you and I first moved in here, we moved into Fishers about the same year, a few months apart. How was the atmosphere was a different place? I'm not saying that's good or a bad thing. I mean, obviously, you have to move forward if you're a city. But we were a very different place at that time, much more a bedroom community of Indianapolis than a community of its own.
It is. It's a lot different from my perspective with my public works glasses on. I've got salt barns right here on the property at our disposal. Back then, we had to drive to 116th and Cumberland Road where the BP Amoco is at, and our 1 or 2 tons of salt that maximum we had on hand was in a barn, and we'd have to go in with a backhoe and retrieve salt out of a barn. Mm-hmm. And if you go in there, if you go too hard, the whole structure would shake.
Oh my gosh.
Never know, it's really
now that's
a lot different.
That's scary.
Compared to now.
I'm going to bring the mayor in here because, Mayor, you first came to Fishers when you were an intern. What year was that?
2006.
So 2006 was your first year to actually be involved with Fishers, involved with what was then the town government as an intern and moved up through the ranks since that time. Talk about your early days as an intern here.
Yeah, I always put Fishers, for a lot of people who are new or employees that are new, I try to put it in perspectives of chapters. So I would say, you know, the first chapter you could go from probably the pre-1980s, you know, that's like literally a small town farm community kind of on the railroad kind of thing. And then you have the what I would call the second chapter, which is what I term it as the Walt Kelly chapter, where Roy Holland, Walt Kelly, those folks kind of ushered in the first generation of the bedroom community. That's when we started to grow a little bit. Not crazy growth, but you started to see people from Indianapolis starting to move up here. People started making plans for what Fishers could become. We started having some companies locate here. And then post-Walt Kelly, the next chapter would be the Scott Faultless chapter, I think. And I say that because Walt Kelly was the council president. Scott Faultless was a council president. So that comes in, I think, Eric, in the like late 90s, early 2000s. And that goes from probably 98 to probably 2008, perhaps.
Yeah.
Something in that time frame. And so then you have everything after that. And each one was kind of had their own flavor, character, and growth, so to speak.
I want to ask Eric about this because I know that as somebody who heads up a department, you've done it as a town and as a city. When you're a town, you have a 7-member town council, and whatever the majority says, that's what happens.
Yep.
And Scott was involved with the town management. He was part. I mean, he was a town manager for a while, and
yep.
And before that, worked underneath within the administration of a town. Explain what it was. Is it different working in the context of a town government versus city? Do you find any big differences between the two as a department head?
Oh, there's been a little more communication with the current city form of government compared to the old days, but it's a different animal from now versus then. I can remember Roy Holland. It was a smaller organization, you know, staff-wise. But Roy Holland, he knew our wife's names and he knew our children's names, and would stop by the office of City Hall and ask how he knew if they were sick. He would stop by. He was exemplary in that regard, and you don't get that nowadays. But we're a lot larger now. It's harder for them to keep up with that.
Well, people know about Holland Park, and they know there's a street named Holland. Yep. We hear the name Roy Holland. Talk a little more about Roy Holland.
Holland was a local man, and it's named after him. And he was a businessman, and he just a friend of the community. And like I said, he really worked hard to keep the employees happy and get engage them and know them at a personal level.
Mayor, obviously you've had a major role in starting the growth of Fishers as a town when you were town manager, and even moving up during those years before you were town manager as your role there in many roles. It's only grown since you were first elected as mayor, obviously, and assumed that role as mayor in 2015. So talk about the growth of Fishers, in two major areas, population and in commercial growth.
Yeah, I think my time in a leadership role here, there was a lot of population growth before I took the leadership role. A lot of people forget that actually, and Eric can attest to this, in the late 90s and early 2000s was probably our fastest population growth time period, where, I mean, you could have 15 subdivisions all under construction at the same time. And they were building an elementary school every other year just to keep up with the growth. My leadership came on the tail end of that kind of robust residential growth. Still had residential growth occurring, but not anything like those early 2000s timeframe. My time is probably more about change than it is about growth, in that we started changing the way we were growing. We started growing more dense development. We started bringing more commercial property into the city landscape, and there was a reason behind that. We understood that for us to be financially sustainable, we couldn't just be homes, and so we had to be very intentional about growing commercial tax base. I think, you know, my time frame is probably the most change that we've seen, but I actually would say that I am not the leader that ushered in the most population growth. I think that probably would have been under the Faultless era, wouldn't you say, Eric?
I would say that Walt teed it up.
Yeah.
The regime teed it up, and Scott brought it home.
I mean, yeah. I think, Larry, just to drive home on this, because Eric used to inspect the private development, and you would tell me stories about the sheer number, like, can you just talk a little bit about how much residential growth was occurring in that 1995 to 2010 timeframe?
As chief inspector, I had two people, me and one inspector. And as Mayor mentioned 15 subdivisions. There was one time we had 25 subdivisions that were laying sanitary pipe and stormwater pipe at the same time. And we would come in and try to manage that and inspect it. And I always joked, it's like coming in riding the bull for 8 seconds, you know, and you do it every day and you do it for a decade. And but you learn who you can trust and who you can't trust. And the ones you can't trust are the ones you spend your time with. Make sure everything's right.
Reputation is everything. And you get it pretty quickly.
But imagine that, Larry, 25 subdivisions all under construction. And this was in a time when once you open that subdivision up for development, in 3 years, it would be complete. I mean, that type of growth in my tenure as mayor, I've never seen 25 subdivisions going at the same time.
And I just to relate to something you mentioned a moment ago, there was an elementary school going up almost one a year.
Yeah.
And this is probably a question for another group of people, but how the school system was able to absorb all those kids every year and still keep academic standards as high as they have.
Well, it's my understanding that the school district worked with the leaders of the community to stifle the growth of the way it was to help them keep up with it, even at that fast pace.
Yeah. Talk a little more, because you have that special vantage point. You've already talked about that in some pretty interesting ways. But obviously your department grew pretty quickly as the city and with the town and the city grew. Talk about managing this growth from your perspective, just overall with your department.
Well, I was drinking from a fire hose, and I don't ever feel like we managed anything in terms of we just maintained it the best we could. It was nice back in the day that everything around here was new, and we could keep up with it because it didn't need much maintenance. But then the life cycle came, everything aged out, and then it was on us to rehab everything or keep everything maintained. So now we're with the change, with Scott coming in and changed the leadership, the way we did government around here, that change was in, what, 2009?
There was a memo. So Eric used to be the assistant director of engineering and public works. So they were combined. Engineering and public works were combined. I went home on a weekend one time, I guess, and wrote a memo saying, here's how we should reorganize city government, and took it to my boss at the time, who was town manager. And he said, yeah, okay, you can go ahead, you know, but you do it, kind of thing. Like, you go sort it out. So I remember I went and told Eric, I said, hey, congratulations, you know, you're going to be the director of public works. And oh, by the way, we're going to change everything. We're going to change how we do all of this. And so we went, it was like a 2-day period where we went around to all these different groups saying, you're no longer working for this guy, you're working for that guy, and here's how it's going to be structured. And everybody was, you know, panicked and scared. And then we got them all kind of settled down for a brief period. And then it wasn't more than, I don't know, 6 months later, I talked to Eric. I said, hey, we're going to take over all the schools stuff as well, and the townships and the libraries. And so Public Works really went through a significant transformation in that probably 9, 10, 11 time frame, Eric, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Having been a manager, Eric, myself, in government years ago, I think that's the scariest thing a staff can have, a big reorganization. Their reporting lines are changing. How did you settle your staff down? How did you try to manage that from a managing personnel point of view?
Well, we had a good vision from the mayor, and he was there every step of the way to help us out on resources and staff and just money just to make sure we could get it done so we wouldn't fail. It was a lot on him.
Yeah, I was going to say money is certainly a big part of it. Let me move to a little different perspective here, Mayor, because when I moved here in 1991 to join my wife, she'd already built a house here in San Blas by the time we were married. She had a small ranch house that she had built herself. At that time, this would have been 1991, this community was a very good place to find a starter home.
Yeah.
Market has obviously changed dramatically since then. So talk about how that whole demographic makeup has changed from the days of 91 when Eric and I moved here and people were building starter homes, ranch houses like my wife and I had, to where we are today is demographically and just the cost of living here.
You know, it's interesting. I would tell you if I dare to call them old timers, but the old guard council would have prided themselves, which is funny we're having this discussion, because they would have prided themselves on having a diversity of housing stock. They really believe that they created opportunities for people to have starter homes all the way up to multi-million-dollar homes. And if you look at Fisher's housing makeup, we actually are fairly diversified. You have very, very high-end expensive homes, and then you have what would have originally, when they were originally built, would have been pretty modest starter homes. What has happened, though, is Fisher's has become such an attractive place to live, and then there's the national trend of just a housing shortage, that all of those that would have been classified as workforce housing or a more attainable housing, their value went up significantly. I mean, you take a Sunblast home. I saw one the other day that was for sale for like $350,000.
That's amazing.
You know, like,
wouldn't have even imagined that,
right?
20 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all those homes that originally were very attainable, a lot of people moved in to Fisher's. You know, anyone who moved in here from 1985 to 1997, I used to call Sunblast like Ellis Island, because everybody started there before they branched out into other places. But the supply and demand issues have really driven most homes in Fisher's to be – I'd be surprised to find a group of homes in Fisher's that aren't worth significantly more today than they were when they first came on the market.
Well, I live in a condo community. Our third home in Fisher's as retirees, and in our small condo community, once a property is up for sale, it doesn't stay up for sale very long.
You know, and this is completely off topic, but I was just thinking – having been a part of this organization, I'm an old-timer now. You know, I started in 06. Eric's practically ancient in the world of Fisher's organization. There are so few people left within this organization that even recognize the names of who I thought were giants. Like, when I first started as an intern, there were names like Mike Booth and Wes Booker and George Kale. Brian Lott, all these names were bigger than life to me because I was just a young kid coming into this organization, and those names meant the world to me. And I watched how they operated, and I understood how they'd Scott Faultless, Stuart Easley. I mean, all these people who were just bigger than life to me. Now, when I walk around this organization, if I were to mention any of those names, no one would have a clue who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really interesting to see that transformation. And that will occur again. I mean, when I depart this organization, no one's going to remember me 5 years from now either. I understand that that's the cycle you go through, but it's interesting to live through it and see that occur.
Yeah, when you're a public person, no matter who you are, 10 to 15 years from now, nobody's going to remember.
It's a fickle sport.
They're not going to remember what I've been doing. No. They won't remember what you've been doing. And even Eric, you're still here. And yet, I got to know, will there be an Eric Pethtel?
He's already working on his own bronze statue. It's going to be made out of salt.
Yeah. Eric, what's being planned for the new City Hall Arts Center, which will soon be opening, is a time capsule. And I understand you have not written anything for it. But if you were asked to write something to somebody that we would read this 50 years from now, what would you say to them? Any idea what you would want to say?
I have not been asked, and I'm glad. I don't know what I would say other than I would share my love of the community and just share some of the experiences that I went through working here, and just hopefully that would be about it, just the love of the community.
You know, I was honored to have been asked to write something for that time capsule. And what I thought about, Mayor, was what would I have written 50 years ago?
Yeah, right.
If I was thinking about that just could never have imagined the advances in technology and the differences we see in society today back then. Your thoughts on writing a time capsule message?
It would be a difficult dialogue. And I guess I'm in a unique perspective because I'm the first mayor the city's ever had. So I guess that puts a degree of novelty on it. I think what I would try to convey is how unique Fishers is in terms of the amount of change a particular community has experienced in such a short period of time. I mean, there are very few communities in the country today that will have experienced the amount of change that this community has in such a short period of time. And change is exciting and difficult all in its own right. And the fact that we're where we are today, that we're strong, we're successful, our community is vibrant, that's not a foregone conclusion. There were many, many people who had to make very difficult decisions in a variety of different ways and have the courage to do the right thing at the right time to get us to where we are to date, to put us in a position for the next 50 years. So, you know, when I look at back at all these people, like I said, these big, big names to me, you know, the Walt Kellys, the Scott Faultlesses, all these guys, I have a deep amount of respect, even though maybe sometimes I didn't even agree with some of the things they might have done in the past. Having been in that role, I have a deep sense of gratitude for kind of the caliber of the people they were and are and the decisions that they made on behalf of the community, because those are not foregone conclusions that everything's going to work out well and that our community is going to be in a good position. And a degree of gratitude for that level of courage that they had, I do appreciate.
And I want to say something just to clarify people who are not familiar with Fishers and the history yet. You know, Eric talked about Roy Holland, whose name you'll see, a prominent citizen in the early days of Fishers. But Walt Kelly served as the president of the town council. And the president of the town council had a very important leadership role.
Absolutely.
The town manager certainly had an important leadership role as basically an employee of the town council at that time. And when Walt Kelly was faced with the decision of becoming a partner at his accounting firm, or, you know, he had to step away from government and chose to do that and ran for mayor. You were involved in that election.
I remember when that very well.
You remember that? We all remember that election. But Walt Kelly was a leader for a number of years, and then Scott Faultless took over as president of the town council for
years. Geist Reservoir, all those homes around Geist Reservoir would not be a part of the city of Fishers today if it wasn't for Scott Faultless. And the amount of grief and hatred and vitriol that Scott took for uniting our community into being what it is today. he got no personal satisfaction or gain out of doing that. He just knew that it was the right thing for the long-term viability of our city. And I mean, I was there in a small capacity as an intern and then just had been hired, but I saw what he went through and holy smokes, that was brutal.
I remember that well. And Eric, you probably do too, because Scott Faultless put that proposal together to annex Geist. The rules for annexation were much different in those days. And really it was the, of all things, property tax caps, and they were memorialized into the state constitution, sort of put that at rest, and then nobody, and the reasons for opposing the annexation sort of went away. But you remember those, did, when that proposal came to you and Scott Faultless said, we want to annex Geist, did that, did your head go, oh my goodness, so what's new for my department?
Well, it had, but it was previous to becoming public because we went out and did some research and knew what was about to be ours or could potentially be ours in terms of roadway. And we went and looked at the road conditions to see what we were inheriting. And so, yeah, we knew it was a monster load. But I got to commend Scott Faultless for what he, his vision back then, because he, that was not a fun time in his life for sure.
And he could have backed away at any time, but he came at a brutal attack and never ever stopped. Mm-mm. He felt that was the right thing to do, and took all the slings on his side. They were pretty tough. Mayor Fadness, that was my memory of that as well. Staying with Eric for a moment, you know, the Department of Public Works is a part of city government in charge of many things. We could talk, you know, for quite a long time about that. But snow removal is obviously a big part of your job. So fortunately, I think we alluded to this earlier, Fishers has not seen many winter storms here in recent years. What I'd like you to do, because we never know when the next one's going to happen, what goes into an effective plan to make sure that you can remove snow when it does come?
Snow removal around here is one of our conversations that never stops. So you could be out on the bridge at Bridge Blast on the 4th of July and be talking about our snow plan, you know. It's always a live document. It's always evolving, but we take it very, very serious, and we try to be the best in the state at that, and many times our peers in the surrounding communities are calling us and asking how we do this and how we do that. So that's something that we're quite proud of.
There's, you know, if you want to talk about a story, Larry, about snow removal that goes back to the 2010 or 11 time frame, Eric and I were out plowing snow one night. He was in his vehicle, I was in mine. It was probably, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something, and we get into this cul-de-sac, and it's hard to see. It's snowing really hard, and Eric runs directly into me with his car, and it tears a hole in the side of his vehicle. And we get back to the DPW garage, and the guys come out, and you can imagine the amount of grief we got because we ran into each other out plowing snow. So then Eric, because we got in an accident, per city policy, we had to go to an accident review board. And there you get to basically make your statement as to what occurred in your accident to see whether you were at fault or not, whether it'd be anything. And Eric gets in there and throws me completely under the bus and not only claims that I ran into him, but then goes on to say that I didn't have the appropriate training for snow removal to be out there in the first place. So, that was an epic night of snow removal.
Well, I'm glad that's a story I hadn't heard before. So, Eric.
Oh, yeah.
So is that your story, and are you sticking to it?
Everything you just heard came from the mouth of a politician.
Well played.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, I want to wrap this up by asking you, each of you, this. I'm going to start with Eric. If you were, let's say, speaking to a group of people, maybe a high school class, anybody, and someone asked you the question, tell me something about Fisher's history that most people don't know, what would you say? Anything come to mind particularly? Let me ask the mayor to start. I'll ask the mayor to start. You can think about that, Eric. If there's something you would want to tell someone, a young person particularly, or just a young family here, tell me something about the history of Fisher's that I probably do not know. What would you want to tell them?
I always go back, and it's not that really exciting. I go back to the population amount in the 90s and 80s. I think people are floored when you tell them in 1980 there were 2,500 people here. Like, they cannot conceptualize how we went from 2,500 to 105,000 in the time frame that we did. I think that's what I always go back to, because it's the best way to demonstrate or articulate just how much change we've actually gone through. I mean, that is extraordinary that we've dealt with that amount of change, and then and not been completely gridlocked, or, you know, have not been able to manage public safety or public works. The fact that we were able to keep up with that, I think, is pretty extraordinary.
And put on top of that, the budget issues you talked about at the top of the podcast makes it more challenging.
Per capita, we have 50% less money per person to provide services than the city next to us that has the same population.
Eric, any thoughts about the history?
I would say that not necessarily the history of Fishers, but with public works thought, nobody in high school raises their hand and says they want a career in public works. But if once you're here and you realize it's such a great community to work for, and the citizens really appreciate the work that we do on a daily basis, it's a wonderful place to be.
One last question for the mayor. I think you talked about Scott Faultless. I think if we go back to the controversial issues you've dealt with, one of them would have to be the decision to build the trail on the train surface. Yeah. And when I look back at that, I mean, I've listened to all of the arguments and that have had the decision has been made, and it's obviously now the trail is in place. The thing that always got to me was I didn't see any future for a train track where the train had been. I mean, there were thoughts of putting some kind of a commuter rail line to downtown Indianapolis. Yeah. I talked to many people. There were huge technical issues with that, expensive ones. If you ever went on that fare train when we had a fare train, I think it went 5 miles an hour.
Yeah,
that
right.
Track was in bad shape. They did the best they could. So as you look back on it, how tough was it for you to deal with all the attacks you had to slings you were taking at that time when you made that decision to transform the nickel plate train line into a trail?
I mean, it was hard. I mean, I got sued multiple times. Sometimes they personally tried to sue me. I had an election over it. I remember one guy wrote just the worst emails to some of my staff, and I finally intervened and just said, look, you can say whatever you want to me, but you're not going to talk to my employees like that. So it was hard, but I don't know. I'm pretty stubborn. I mean, once I get something in my head that I think it's the right thing to do, I just go do it. And so, you know, these big ideas, they shouldn't come that easy, right? There should be a little work and consternation to them. And I'm glad it worked out for the best. And I always thought it was interesting when people were advocating for this mass transit, you know, for that to be functional. You're talking about trains going by probably every 7 to 12 minutes mm-hmm. to make that actually convenient for people to actually use. I can't even fathom what that would mean to the neighbors that call that trail adjacent to them today. Like, imagine a train going by your house, and it would start probably in the 5 a.m. time period mm-hmm. to hit the commuters mm-hmm. from 5 a.m. till 10 at night, a train going by your house every 7 minutes. I mean, it just didn't even make sense that would be even logical. And what I dealt with, I think, were train enthusiasts, which I underestimated how many there were out there. And then nostalgia, a lot of nostalgia over people's personal memories of that. But not a whole lot of like competing future. There wasn't a whole lot of people saying, no, this is why this is a better outcome. It was just more people's passion for trains or their nostalgia over what was. And those are emotional connections. And it's very hard to rationalize when they're drawing on that. It wasn't a conversation over two different viable future uses. It was, here's a viable future use to trail, and here's your emotional connection to what was. And that was tough.
I want to thank Mayor Scott Fadness, Eric Pethtel, a lot of Fisher's history. It's always fun to talk about history, and we had a chance to do that today. And we will have that time capsule, which will be planted underneath the City Hall and Arts Center, which will be opening in May and June. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a great conversation.
Thank you.